Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Serene. I am absolutely delighted to have with me today none other than Raffi Berg, who is the author of Red Sea Spies, which I'll be talking about in great detail. But for those of you who have missed the publishing sensation that occurred last week, Red Sea Spies is about the entire operation to get Ethiopian Jews out of Ethiopia. But they did it via an entire cover operation on the Sudanese Red Sea coast, where a large group of Mossad agents were posing as diving instructors and tourist operators running a resort on the Red Sea. It is a fantastic story. Raffi is the Middle East editor of the BBC News website, but in his spare time over the last year plus, he has been beavering away writing this book and interviewing what must be scores of Ethiopian Jews, Mossad agents, Israeli Air Force pilots. I mean, it's an incredible undertaking. Raffi, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And you are in the whirlwind of your book having just been published. I mean, I've given a brief synopsis there, but I mean, I really want to just start by just asking you, I mean, how did you uncover this story and when?
Well, like all the best stories, I stumbled across it. It was a few years ago when I read that a movie was being planned about an operation to smuggle Ethiopian Jews out of Sudan using a holiday resort. In passing over the years, I'd read smatterings about it, fragments here and there, but it was the news that the film was being planned that reignited my interest. Then I went away, and just for personal curiosity, not for professional reasons, I started to research it, and quite frankly, what I found just blew me away.
And so when did that process begin? So it's now sort of February 2020. I mean, when did that all start?
Well, I think I first noticed this in about 2015, but it wasn't until 2018 that I decided that this would make a very interesting feature. So I proposed it to my editor at the BBC News website. He was interested in the idea. I went off to Israel, as a matter of fact, to do something separate. But in parallel, I wrote the feature and I interviewed a couple of people while I was over there, a couple of former Mossad agents who filled me in on bits and pieces. I put the story together, published it on the website with the very enticing headline, The Holiday Village Run by Spies. And the response was unbelievable. To date, more than 5.5 million people have read this story.
And where does that pitch it in terms of a story of BBC News website? Is that completely new?
Okay, so on a good day, if a story does really, really well, it will clock about 1 million right. readers. Maybe a bit more, maybe a bit less. But 5.5 million is, I mean, I'd use the word unprecedented.
So, I mean, let's try and break down the story, because there's different elements to it. And I think one of the things that's absolutely fantastic about the story is it's not just about the Mossad operation. It's not just about the Israelis. There's a lot in there about Ethiopian Jews, about their lives, about the history of what's going on in Ethiopia, and just how risky and dangerous all this was. So let's start with the first bit of the story that you clearly were incredibly attracted to and wanted to really take this story to the world, which is actually the Ethiopian Jews themselves and their own desire, real sort of obsession to try and get out and get to Israel.
That's right. When I started this enterprise, I knew very little about the Ethiopian Jews. I'd heard of Operation Moses. I could probably tell you a thing or two about it. When I researched the book in depth and I started to learn about the Ethiopian Jewish community, I discovered what an unbelievable community, a special community this is. You're right, they existed for centuries, driven by an ancestral longing to return to the land of their ancestors, which they didn't call the land of Israel, they called it the land of Jerusalem. And every generation they expected that the day would come when they would leave Ethiopia and go back to the land of Jerusalem. For decades after the state was established, they weren't even recognized by the rabbinical establishment or the state in Israel as proper Jews. That only changed in 1977 with the election of Menachem Begin, when a lot of things were turned on their head. And he gave the order to the head of the Mossad to quote, bring me the Jews of Ethiopia. Mm. And that's how this entire episode began.
But some of the received narrative about the sort of rescue of Ethiopian Jews, and my own experience, actually, I worked with some of the Ethiopian Jewish community when I was a volunteer in Dimona many years ago. And I remember there was this idea that, like, sort of they'd been rescued and they'd sort of, you know, they were there and they'd been taken away. And one of the things I think your book does really well is it just shows it wasn't just about them being rescued. The sheer hardship of them trekking hundreds of kilometres through, for anybody who's been to Addis and areas in Ethiopia where some of the Jews are from, it's incredibly mountainous, it's very difficult terrain, this is not like a desert trek. And they are doing this hundreds of kilometres with barely any food, young families. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. And a lot of them died on the way. I mean, you explain that as well in the book.
That's right. And you raise a very, very important point, and it's something which I stress in the book. It's a common misperception that the Ethiopian Jews were rescued by the Mossad. Even the Mossad operatives don't like that terminology, and certainly the Ethiopian Jews themselves don't. And there's a very good reason for this. That's because they were actually their own agents of their own fate. Mm. The Ethiopian Jews were the ones who, as you described, they went on this tremendous, this horrendous odyssey to get to walk by foot, to get from Ethiopia across the border into Sudan. And it was hellish for them. As you said, they climbed up mountains, down mountains, across rivers, through jungle, across desert, with very little or nothing at all in way of provisions, water or food. And about 16,000 of them eventually made this journey. And of that number, about 1,500 perished.
Mm. It's a real high human cost there, a huge, huge risk. So the next stage of it is then the Mossad starts to prioritise trying to get the Ethiopian Jews out. And one of the key, if not the key character in the story, is Danny, who is the lead Mossad operator. And could you tell us a bit about him and what you think of him as a character, and what attributes he brought to this? Because it seems like without his creativity and without his sort of controlled rule-breaking and sort of genius, I suppose, none of this would really have happened.
No, it wouldn't have happened. Danny, I know very well. I now count him among one of my very good friends. When I first met him, I kind of didn't really know who it was that I was dealing with. It was only after having met him a number of times and listened more and more to what he had to say that it started to dawn on me that I was actually sitting across a table from a legend. He's a very modest guy, but he is he's super bright and he's mesmerising. We first met, it sounds very cloak and daggerish, we first met in the departure terminal of Charles de Gaulle Airport. He wanted to check me out. He wouldn't speak to me over the phone. I discussed with him the prospect of writing a book. He went away and thought about it, and I heard from him several weeks later to say that he'd taken advice, he'd thought it through, and it was something that he was ready to document. He had worked as a consultant on the Netflix movie Red Sea Diving Resort, and he felt that if it was left to that movie, that would create a bit of a myth about what actually happened.
So there's been some criticism of that film. Doesn't it do what a lot of Hollywood films do? It sort of very much overplays the American role, would you say?
Yeah, on the one hand, look, in all fairness to the movie, it doesn't claim to be the real story. Yeah. As it goes out of its way, as a matter of fact, it puts on screen in letters that that the film is inspired by true events, not even based on, but it chooses carefully the word inspired by. So that gives it creative license to be as fanciful as it likes. And it takes liberties, but it gives you an idea, a loose idea of what happened.
Mm. But Danny was the key in terms of how he built up to what was an operation at the beginning, using fake passports, getting very small numbers of people out on flights, which in itself had its own genius, and using all sorts of different ways to try and use the system and the chaos that there was in these refugee camps in Sudan. But then they take the leap of having to get much larger numbers of Ethiopian Jews out, and that's how they find the need to build this diving resort. So can you tell us a bit about how they took that jump?
That's right. So to begin with, as you say, they were getting numbers, relatively small numbers of Ethiopian Jews out of Sudan, rather. And the way they were doing this was through Khartoum Airport. They were effectively smuggling them out, passing them off as non-Jewish refugees. As the numbers of Ethiopian Jews crossing into Sudan increased, Danny felt that they needed to scale up the operation. He suggested moving from the airport as a single way out to using the Israeli Navy to transport the Jews from the beaches of Sudan. He went to have a look along the coast to look for suitable landing bays. And it was while he was doing that that he stumbled across an abandoned resort. And it occurred to him, this is the genius of the guy, it occurred to him there and then that if the Mossad could get hold of this place and refit it, turn it into a Club Med-style resort, they could use it as a legitimate base for operatives to live and work at during the daytime and carry out smuggling people, effectively people smuggling operations in the desert at night.
Mm. And it took them a long time, but essentially they did manage to build a functioning diving resort with guests. And by all means, it was a pretty amazing place to stay, which is also extraordinary about the tale.
It sounds like an amazing place. I spoke to former guests who stayed there at the time, and they had no idea that their diving instructors and the management were Israeli Mossad agents. And they were, as you would imagine, quite amazed when I revealed this to them. But they did say to me, more than one person said to me, thinking back, they can see now that it did appear a little bit unusual that perhaps at times when the resort was quiet with guests, there were a lot of staff, and staff were well-toned, fit and athletic, and that the resort was actually a very isolated place. So it was stuck on a peninsula. There was no proper infrastructure. By all logic, it shouldn't have succeeded, but it did, because the Mossad... Well, to run a place like that, to make it viable, you can only really do it with an organisation like the Mossad behind it.
But they actually, they certainly didn't lose money. I mean, you sort of imply in the book that they actually were able to make some money, not a profit, but they actually did bring some money back to the Israeli taxpayers.
That's right, 100%. It was a great success as a holiday enterprise. The Mossad published glossy brochures advertising it, which were placed in diving stores and travel agents across Europe, and it attracted interest from all four corners of the world. Not just ordinary people like you and I, forgive me for saying so, ordinary people, but also top diplomats as well, ambassadors, including the American ambassador, and even ambassadors from countries such as Iraq and Sudan itself, which were technically in a state of war with Israel. Mm-hmm. They went and stayed there. They didn't know that the people they were chatting to, having cups of tea with, and playing backgammon with were actually Mossad agents.
And what do you know what's happening there now? Presumably you haven't been there.
I'd love to go there. I haven't been there yet. It's one of my ambitions, as you would imagine.
Yeah.
Afterwards, let's say, once the Mossad had pulled out, which they did in dramatic fashion, the Sudanese authorities requisitioned the site. And to begin with, they used it as a military garrison. And one of the remarkable things I uncovered, as if this story wasn't jam-packed with incredible episodes as it is, one of the most remarkable things I uncovered was one of the people who lived there after the Mossad, there's no direct connection, but after the Mossad, was Osama bin Laden. Mm. So when he was expelled from Saudi Arabia in 1991, he settled in Sudan. The first place he stayed at was the Arous resort that the Mossad had fitted at the cost of $100,000.
He stayed at a Mossad fitted diving resort. I mean, one of the amusing things as well is that when I was reading this, I looked it up on Google Maps, and it's actually there, and somebody has posted some of the pictures from the book for the original publicity of the diving resort, and it actually says cozy, good for kids, if you look on it now, so you can actually see exactly where it is. But going back to the story, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, because I think that our listeners should really go out, buy the book and give it a read. But if you could just give us some of the insight around what you uncovered from the Israeli military operation, because there were three parts to this. There was the Mossad agents on the ground, but then, you know, it wouldn't have existed as well beyond without the help of this incredible group of people from the Israeli Navy, and then later on from the Israeli Air Force, because they were doing evacuations by sea and then later by air. If you could give some insight from some of the interviews you had with some of these people, because their stories are also extraordinary.
Yes, that's right. So to begin with, I must say that in its entirety, this was a Mossad-led operation from A to Z. There's been nothing like it before. There hasn't been anything like it since. Well, certainly not in the public domain. It began with Mossad agents transporting the Jews from refugee camps to Khartoum and smuggling them out through the airport. Then when they decided to scale up the operation, as I hinted at, they shifted to maritime evacuations, which involved an Israeli Navy mothership called the Bat Galim, which would sail from Eilat down to the off the coast of Sudan. Then they would dispatch Israeli Navy SEALs to rendezvous with the Mossad on the shores, pick up the Ethiopian Jews, transport them back to the Bat Galim, and sail back to Israel. Now, I spoke to the commander of the ship, the Bat Galim. And he told me some remarkable stories, including, well, there were many, but one I recall, which isn't actually in the book, but it's worth mentioning. One of when they took on board the Ethiopian Jews, they had doctors on board, and a young Ethiopian Jewish girl was very poorly, and she was diagnosed with meningitis. Mm-hmm. So it was decided in the Mossad to dispatch a helicopter to airlift her back for emergency medical treatment in Israel, and they dispatched a helicopter from Israel, and it was on its way to the ship to airlift her. But she made a sufficient recovery for them to call it off. But I think that just goes to show the levels and the extent and the lengths that Israel went to look after these people.
Yeah, and they had this whole sort of operation, didn't they, where they sort of kitted the entire boat out to sort of look after the refugees on board, but also they involve, you know, very large numbers of the kind of Zodiac craft with outboard motors, commandos going aboard, securing the shore. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary that this was all being done under the nose of the authorities and military and presumably Coast Guard and Navy of a hostile state, Sudan, at the time. So it's incredibly dangerous. But I mean, one question I had is, do we think in today's technology that this would have been possible? Because, I mean, at the time, it feels a little bit like, you know, back in the 80s, late 70s, maybe some of the surveillance equipment that a state like Sudan would have seemed maybe a little bit more rudimentary. Like, would it have been possible now? Did you think that? Did you ask that?
I did. The short answer is no.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be possible. Not in the way that it was carried out, because, as you say, technology has moved on. We're living in a very different world where, you know, as soon as you leave your house, somebody can tell exactly where you are. Whether Israel could pull this kind of thing off again, well, I'm sure it could. It's done similar operations before, and ingenious operations have been carried out successfully since. But in my mind, the rescue of hostages at Entebbe compares anything to anything like this as a case where Israel has pulled off the impossible.
And then the operation extends to actually just flying in very large planes and landing them in Sudan, C-130 Hercules. And I mean, that was also in its own way extraordinary, sort of pilots flying these Hercules so they're not detected by radar, very low, sometimes without using light, all the way from Israel, landing, picking up again, securing like the airfield area. I mean, tell us a bit about that. I mean, what you must have heard from some of those pilots must have been incredible.
Yes, they flew, as you say, without lights, which is virtually impossible to do at the best of times. But we're talking about flying so low that you under the detection abilities of enemy radar, and there's a string of mountains on the coast of Sudan called the Red Sea Hills. So they had to navigate mountains without any light. They had to eventually land in desert, simply on landing strips which weren't tarmacked. These are flat stretches of desert. And then we have to think about the Ethiopian Jews themselves. Remember, they came from the highlands of Ethiopia. They hadn't seen a motor car in some cases, let alone a Hercules aircraft. So suddenly they had to go from their villages and ultimately walk into the belly of a roaring Hercules C-130 aircraft and be spirited away to Israel. One of them described it like he imagined he was the prophet Jonah in the belly of a whale. Others spoke of an alien craft landing. I mean, to them, it was like being transported to another world.
Mm, extraordinary. So in terms of the actual process, I mean, I think some of our listeners will be interested to know, like, you know, from idea to getting to a book and sort of doing all these interviews, I mean, how long did all that take? I mean, how many interviews? Like, what was your sort of secret to sort of just getting this, you know, enormous job done?
Well, my secret perhaps was being laser focused. Right. I had a tight deadline to deliver this book, and you know, with sufficient planning and doing a lot of things simultaneously and in parallel, you know, it was possible. But I went on many trips to Israel. I carried out tens of hours of interviews with participants. And this is everybody from downwards, but Danny upwards as well. One of those I interviewed a number of times was Ephraim Halevi. Yeah. Ephraim Halevi, just to inform listeners who may not be that familiar with the name, later became the head of Mossad itself. At the time, he was the commander of the division which Danny operated under. So I spoke to Ephraim, Danny, the members of the team he recruited, Hercules pilots who flew on these missions, sailors from the Bat Galim, Ethiopian Jews themselves, and they all had tremendous tales to tell.
And this was the first time that they'd all told their stories, and they hadn't really done that before, had they?
This is the first time they have told the story in full. Mm. And by that I mean that there were people who spoke to me on the record and off the record, some who would be identified, some who wouldn't be identified. Mm. But I have to say that because of the figure that and the reputation that Danny had, when he would call somebody and say, look, I'd like you to speak to Rafi Burke, he's got my blessing, mm. then doors were open to me. Right. So I spoke to people who you didn't even know existed,
right.
and to this day still live in the shadows.
Mm. So that kind of unlocked it. Fantastic. Well, I think we will probably draw to a close, but I want to just say to our listeners that the book was published last Thursday. It's published by Icon Books. It's called Red Sea Spies. It is published for our US listeners in April. You'll have to wait, I'm afraid, until April, but you can listen to Rafi talking about his book at Jewish Book Week on Wednesday the 4th of March at 8:30 if you want to get tickets. But I didn't want to give too much away in terms of the story. There are plenty of nuggets that we have not even touched upon. We have not even gone into detail about the absolutely incredible aspects of the story, as in how the Mossad agents managed to get cover and clearance from people at the heart of the Sudanese regime. And there's one that we can maybe mention, is just about how they managed to sort of win over one of the most senior people in the Sudanese sort of intelligence structure by offering to give him fresh lobsters that they caught every week. How did you find out that bit of the story?
That's right. Well, Danny and others who were part of this particular episode, they told me about it. The person in question was the head of the Navy.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get much higher than that. And he agreed to give the... Clearly, he didn't know they were Mossad operatives, but he agreed to give them every assistance they needed in running this resort if one of the conditions was they supplied him with fresh lobsters, which is what they did.
And they actually had to go out and hunt for those lobsters.
They had to go out and hunt for those lobsters, which, of course, remember, this was a diving resort. Yeah. So when they took guests on diving expeditions, then they collect the lobsters at the same time.
Yeah. Well, Rafi, thank you so much for joining us. We will leave it there. I will urge, again, our listeners to read it. I obviously read a lot of books for this podcast and people I interview, and I have to say some of them are heavier going than others, but this was an absolute delight to read, and I just sort of powered through it in sort of a day and a half on the weekend. It is, as the publisher said, pretty much unputdownable once you get going. So do buy a copy and read it and enjoy it. Red Sea Spies, Rafi Berg, the author, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.